The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Canada, Christmas Eve all over the world, and I hope you are celebrating safely with your friends. Thanksgiving for having them around you. Please remember our appeal for Angel Tree. Even at this late hour, you can help us serve the children who have one or both parents in prison. There is a banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. As you're wrapping your presents, maybe go over there and drop something into our Angel Tree appeal on behalf of these thousands and thousands of children that we can help on this Christmas Eve. So pleased to have you here on Christmas Eve. And now get ready for a very enjoyable Christmas with one of my old and dear friends from Fuller Theological Seminary, formerly down at the Laity Lodge in Texas. He's up back with me on Christmas Eve, Dr. Mark Roberts.
Well, thank you, Hugh. Merry Christmas to you and to your listeners.
A song and story. That's what we're talking about today.
Indeed.
Now, I want to start very, very basically. How long have we been celebrating Christmas in the sort of way that we celebrate Christmas?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because the celebrations of Christmas have changed over the years. The real answer, the way we have been in America, is probably only the last 50 or 60 years. Now, there have been historical roots to much of what we do. But some of the things that we consider a very standard Christmas practice turn out to be relatively recent. Some of the things we do with Santa Claus, for example, are newer.
You mean the Budweiser Clydesdales? Those haven't been around for 400
years.
Well,
no, those go way back to the Middle Ages. Okay. But some of the other things are newer. And yet there are some of our traditions, especially the tradition of setting aside a day in the year or a period of time in the year to remember the birth of Christ. Now, that goes back all the way to the very first centuries of Christendom.
We'll get to that in the third hour. Right. I want to talk about the music in this hour and next primarily because carols are perhaps the most treasured portion of the season outside of, as David Allen White has said to me, midnight mass for Catholics or midnight observance for Protestants. That's the heart of the religious side. But carols cross over both religious and cultural. Where does this come from?
Well, that's fascinating. And the story of carols and their popularity is really something. You know, they are some of the most favorite and beloved of music, even by people who aren't necessarily believers, you know. I mean, you've got Barbara Streisand's got a Christmas album out, and last time I checked, she wasn't a notable Christian. But there's something about Christmas carols that touches the heart, even of folk who aren't necessarily believers. Some of that's nostalgia.
Sure. You know?
And, of course, some of it is just the more of the romantic nature of many of the songs. But I actually think there is something embedded in the Christmas carol that's a good one anyway, that's a deeper reality that touches the human heart, that touches the spirit and the spirit's longing for God and to know God.
I want to stay on the nostalgia thing for just a moment. I can still remember the big, what do you call those Motorola players, the big sets that would sit in the living room, which was just a record player.
Right, a hi-fi or whatever.
Yeah, but it took up the size of basically, you know, a desk.
Yes,
and
before iPod.
Yeah, there were eight or nine different albums, which would play throughout the year in Hewitt Central in Warren, Ohio. And those are the sorts of carols. And we play a lot of them on the program during this time of year. So the nostalgia aspect, it does take people back to home and family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think almost more than anything else, a Christmas carol has that power to bring us back, especially those of us who grew up as Christians or grew up at least celebrating Christmas. It has the power to bring us back to beloved times. And again, there's that romantic quality. And that, frankly, can work even for folk who aren't necessarily Christians. I have a friend who grew up as an Orthodox Jew. He couldn't have a Christmas tree in his house. That was completely forbidden. But on Christmas morning, his grandparents would nevertheless put a cardboard Santa in the fireplace, and there would be presents sitting by it.
Okay, so he likes Christmas.
So, yeah, probably the Santa songs were okay, just not the Jesus
songs. Now, we don't call them Christmas songs. We don't call them Christmas tunes or Christmas melodies. We call them Christmas carols. Why is that?
Well, that's a great question. The word carol in English comes actually from the Old English, which comes from the from an old French word, carol, with a E on the end of it. And initially, that referred to a circle dance. It's a folk dance, the kind you'll often see people
A French folk doing. Dance?
Yes, where they dance around in circles. Now, this was a long time ago,
Okay.
Not modern France.
Okay.
But when they would dance in this circle, there would be songs, and the song had a certain pattern. We would basically think of it as a song that has a verse and then a repeating chorus. And so the word carol initially referred to a popular song, a folk song, if you will, that had this verse and chorus pattern and was often used for those kinds of dances that are called circle dances. And so historically, and if you read, for example, the New Oxford Book of Carols, they'll make a distinction between Christmas hymns that are the sacred ones and Christmas carols that are the popular songs. Mostly that doesn't hold up anymore. Another ironic thing is that there used to be carols for other seasons, too. There were Easter carols. There were summer carols. Again, it was just a popular folk song for
dancing. The New Oxford Book of Carols?
Oh, yes, there is such a thing.
What is that?
Well, it's in some ways, it's the definitive academic text for carols. What are the right words? What are the right lyrics? It's got some history with it. You get it in paperback for, I don't know, $30. If you're like me, it's a fascinating read. Probably won't make the top of Amazon. But if you want to buy it, you can buy it. And you can learn more about Christmas carols than you want to know from really a reliable source. One of the things, and we'll get into this, there are many kind of myths and legends about some of the Christmas carols. Some are actually true.
Was Silent Night designed to be played on a guitar by a man whose organ had broken down?
Yes and no. We'll get into that a little bit.
Okay.
There is truth there, and there is a bit of a legend, yes. But the New Oxford Book of Carols is one of the definitive sources. But it makes distinctions between, for example, hymns and carols that most of us wouldn't make anymore. Over time, and especially within the last century, the word carol has been so closely associated with Christmas that now we would call Christmas songs, whether they're hymns or folk songs or whatever, we would refer to them all as carols.
Any summer carols dancing around in your mind there? Are there any that are still out there?
No, because I'm not French. I suppose if I were, I'd
summer
be out dancing
with
in circles.
With the wine or something. So have Christians always sung carols at Christmas time?
Well, yes and no. See, it turns out all of this is a little more complicated than we think. You asked early on, how long have we been celebrating Christmas the way we have? If you go back and look at the history, the long history of Christmas celebrations, there's a lot of variety. Part of that is there's always this tension between the, you might say, the Christian or the spiritual celebration of Christmas and the secular or historically the pagan celebration. A lot of the early carols, that is the folk songs, were either secular or pagan in their origin. And so the church tended not to be all that pumped up about them. There were hymns or sacred music, usually chanted music in the church about the birth of Jesus, sort of the precursor to the spiritual side of things. And so there was historically this tension. And often the church wasn't very pumped at all or excited about carol singing, namely the folk songs. They wanted only to have the more appropriate music sung, which, by the way, in church was not sung by the congregation. It would be sung by a choir or by the leaders. Congregational singing didn't come until 16th, 17th century and beyond. And so did Christians always sing carols? Yes, sort of. Did people in the wintertime, especially in Europe, sing Christmas folk songs, various Yule songs, and other kinds of winter celebration songs? Yes. Did the church use its music for Christmas? Yes. Often with kind of curious tensions. At many points, the church leaders tried to abolish the singing of the popular songs.
They wouldn't have, the Desert Fathers wouldn't have liked Frosty at all. That would have been pagan.
Well, yeah, indeed. And in fact, in the...
It's kind of pagan still.
Well,
go running around and...
Frosty, you've got to work. You just got to look out for, because he's he's a scary guy. But
yes.
if you look back... 7th century, the Catholic Church had a council, got a council together, and decided to outlaw the singing of popular carols. That is the non-spiritual stuff.
The Yule stuff.
Yes. And
there was an edict?
There was indeed, from a council. And it really didn't work very well. They tried again in the 13th century to do it, and that didn't work very well. Curiously, in the 17th century in England, you know, for a period of time, the Puritans took over.
The Roundheads, yeah.
And one of the things they did, they didn't only outlaw Christmas carols. They did, in fact, outlaw Christmas. You could not celebrate Christmas, period.
They were a bunch of cut-ups, weren't they, the Cromwell guys?
They were having too much fun.
Everyone, they had the fun police out there.
It's curious, if you read some of their concerns, it was that there was way too much fun happening in the society. Now, in fairness to these folk, the Christmas celebrations of those days weren't like our Christmas celebrations. They were more like, you know, Mardi Gras in New Orleans or something. There was a pretty high level of debauchery.
I don't know if you talk about office parties. We come back. We'll carry on that theme, what the Cromwellian Puritans were up to. Go nowhere, America. It's a special Christmas Eve broadcast with Mark Roberts, markdroberts.com. There's our pagan song. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Christmas Eve edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Frosty the Snowman is a fairy tale, they say. He was made of snow, but the children know that he came to life one day. There must have been some magic in that old silk hat they found. For when they placed it on his head, he began to dance around.
Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384.
800-500-8384. Oh, holy night, the stars are bright and shine.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt with Mark D. Roberts. Pastor Mark is also a scholar, theologian, teacher, author. His weblog, markdroberts.com, much visited for sort of a common sense evangelical view of the world from a scholarly perspective. And last year he helped me do a Christmas Eve show, the first hour of which will repeat in the third hour today. But he's back this year in a conversation about caroling that actually took us before the break to the question of when is too much fun too much fun? The Puritans didn't much care for Christmas revels. And I want to pick up on that. Did that travel with the pilgrims, by the way?
Well, it did, interestingly enough. In fact, there's a log from the Mayflower in 1620 in which the one who was keeping it's the web log of 1620, really,
yep.
The guy in the Mayflower.
Yep.
And he talks about Christmas Day and pretty much is very clear about the fact that nobody took the day off. That was one of the
ways. This is William Bradford?
It was about Bradford's time.
Okay.
And everybody worked, but the guy's very clear everybody worked on Christmas. Then actually the next year, 1621, there was some debate about whether they're going to celebrate Christmas or not and take time off or not. And Bradford was of the mind that you do not take the day off. You don't honor it in any way because it's an unbiblical practice, he would have argued. There's no biblical warrant for celebrating Christmas. But he gave in to sort of the popular demand to have a time off and let people do that. Well, he happened upon people who were playing games in the street, and he was furious because he thought they would take the time off for sort of solemn fasting and prayer, not for fun. And so he basically took their toys away, and that was the end of the celebration.
The first Grinch.
Well, indeed. And again, I think in fairness to these folk, we need to recognize that some of the celebrations were not all that great. I've got this wonderful line from Increase Mather, who is one of the Puritan leaders.
One of my favorite names in all of American history.
Well, yes. I know you named one of your children Increase, but that's kind of...
Not true.
But, but anyway, Increase Mather is complaining about Christmas in Massachusetts. He talks about all these people. He says they are consumed in compotations, in interludes, in playing at cards, in reveling, in excess of wine, in mad mirth.
It's kind of like a radio team. What was that first word? Compotation.
Drinking. You know, a potion.
Okay.
So that's drinking with other people. A symposium. But you'll find this complaint commonly, and it's really fair that much of the secular and or pagan celebration of Christmas in England and in America for a period of time was, you mentioned the office party. It was like an office party on drugs.
Yep. So why did they survive? Why did Christmas Carol survive? If they went through the Puritan kind of starkness and the Reformation, how did they make it through?
Well, it's fascinating. Partly, I think, as much as certain religious folk, and I'm not one of them, by the way, but would say that we really ought to be serious and solemn most of the time, the human spirit likes to celebrate and rejoice, and some people even dance. I'm not much of a dancer either, but there's something about the human beings that wants to celebrate and loves fun music, and Christmas carols have been that kind of fun music. There were people in Christian history, though, who really made an effort to reach out and to build a bridge between the church and the secular celebration and the common folk. And one of those, ironically, was St. Francis.
So stand by. I'll be right back with more with Dr. Roberts after more of Mark Roberts on Christmas carols when we return. Don't forget, though, to go over to HughHewitt.com. And remember, the Angel Tree Appeal is at the top of the website. It simply says up there the Christmas tree with two children on either side. Those represent the 370,000 children that Angel Tree, a ministry of prison fellowship, serves every Christmas. With love, with attention, with fellowship, with a note from mom or dad, a present from mom or dad, a Bible, and a relationship that extends all year long. And we've done an amazing job. Thousands and thousands of children have been served by this program's audience. But on this Christmas Eve, as you wrap up your presents, just perhaps please go there and make another gift. And remember, all these children who do not have mom or dad there and are trying to stay in touch with them, you're making that happen. That's your Christmas Eve present to people who otherwise would not have a Christmas. Thank you very much. HughHewitt.com at the very top, the banner, Angel Tree. I'll be right back with Mark Roberts. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt on Christmas Eve. I hope you have a great day ahead of you. Some of you are already on the road. 50 degrees here in Virginia, but I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. Thank you for being generous over at Salvation Army. I am joined by Dr. Mark Roberts, my friend for forever. Although we did not know each other as undergraduates, pretty much we have known each other for 30 years.
In 1223 A.D., he was in the town of Greccio in Italy. And he decided that he was going to do an experiment as a way of connecting the people into the spiritual celebration of Christmas. And his idea, he was apparently about the first to come up with it, was to have what we would call a living nativity scene or a creche. And so he got various people to act out the parts, had a real baby for the baby Jesus, had real animals, a real stable, and they had their worship service right around that time. And part of that service involved singing not only of the religious chants of the day, but singing in a popular mode about the birth of Jesus. And so there was that effort at that point to connect the popular and the delightful music with the serious and solemn celebration of the birth of Christ. And that happened many times over, ultimately, as we get into the 18th century and especially the 19th century in Britain, those connections are stronger and stronger.
Before we move into Britain, is it fair to say then that St. Francis sort of invented the manger scene that we see a thousand times when they're not being driven out of the public square?
Indeed. That is, in fact, something that is often attributed to him. Now, the scholars who go back and look into it have said that that sort of thing was done in some of the villages in Italy before Francis. But he is the one then who took that tradition and popularized it. And yeah, so one of the reasons that we do what we do on Christmas Eve in our own church and we get our children and act out the nativity scene, that's really directly related back to what Francis did in 1223.
Oh, interesting. Now, of course, this is on the continent. In England, as we said, the Puritans got into the saddle and almost killed it off. Why?
Well, their concerns were several. And number one, they were concerned about just the excesses of partying, which involved things like vandalism. When they tried to outlaw Christmas, there were riots in the cities. But there was a roughness about the celebration. Again, it may be a little bit like some of the Halloween celebrations like in Detroit, where things get out of hand.
Right.
And so there was a legitimate concern about the excesses. That's one issue for the Puritans. Another issue was, of course, that much of the Christmas celebration was, in fact, pagan. And rather than getting messed up with that, they just said we'd get rid of it. Now, the Puritans had another agenda, too, which was not to do Catholic things. And the Roman Catholic Church had always been more open to Christmas. You know, we talked about Francis. And so there's that issue. And finally, for the Puritans, they tried to say that if it's not in the Bible, if we're not commanded to do it in the Bible, we shouldn't do it. And you can't turn to any passage in the Bible that says celebrate the birth of Jesus in this way. They said, therefore, we ought not to do it. And so for those variety of reasons, they tried to shut it down.
Well, pause there for a moment, just theologically. It would seem to me that the counterargument would be the celebratory portions of the Gospel of Luke, which we'll talk about in the third hour today, would give some license to people to at least interpret that as a time of great joy, peace on earth, goodwill yeah. towards men, present giving by the wise men, that sort of thing.
Sure.
What would the Puritans say about that?
Well, again, they would point to the excesses. They would say, but though those things are good, we ought not to indulge in them all too much. They were greatly afraid of sort of excess reveling. Too much partying is not a good thing. I think they were probably warm and friendly people within their families, but they weren't party animals. Let's just say that.
Now, how did Carol's Christmas generally make a comeback from where Increase Mather and Bradford and the English Puritans had sent it?
Well, you know, that's interesting. And partly the Puritan effort didn't work. But something else came along not terribly far after the Puritans that really did seem to extinguish Christmas for a while. And that was the whole industrialization and urbanization in England. And as people moved from their little villages into the cities, they lost touch with their roots, with their traditions. They had to work all the time. There weren't days off for Christmas. By the way, when Scrooge worries about giving a day off to Cratchit, I mean, that was common not to grant a holiday for Christmas. And so in the urban areas in England, there just wasn't too much recognition of Christmas. It was perhaps preserved out in the little villages here and there, but fewer and fewer of the people lived in the villages.
So how to get back into what we have now?
In the early 19th century, a number of authors came along and rehabilitated it. For example, Clement Moore, who wrote what was once called A Visit from St. Nicholas. We know it as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. He wrote that in the early 19th century, and it was a poem like that that gave life to that particular story. Washington Irving had some writings that, in a sense, romanticized the former days of Christmas and gave people a desire to begin to experience something like that.
Do you remember anything in particular that Irving wrote? Because I've read his stuff about Ichabod Crane recently in connection with John Kerry, actually. But I was wondering, I don't recall him doing revels. But
no, he had a piece, and I can't remember its exact name. I'll put it up on the website if anybody wants to track it down. But he had a piece where he talked about old Christmas, and this guy is kind of looking out the window and seeing the beauty of the winter day and sort of the carols wafting on the breeze. And there's this really tremendous sort of romantic view of what old Christmas was like.
Oh, uh-huh, interesting.
And he did
track that down.
Two or three different pieces of writing. But the king of rehabilitating Christmas was Charles Dickens. In fact, the London Times in 1988 referred to him as the man who invented Christmas. that he, in his writings, did more both to rehabilitate but also to kind of transform Christmas more than anybody else. And a little later on in the show, I think it would be fun to talk even more in depth about Dickens and his writings in the Christmas Carol. But, for example, in the traditional celebration of Christmas, religiously, Christmas was a 12-day holiday. Now, if you're a business owner in London in the mid-19th century, you're not going to give people 12 days off.
Right.
Dickens, for example, was one who really refashioned Christmas to be basically a 1 or a 2 day holiday, having largely to do with getting together with family, playing games and enjoying good food. It wasn't about, you know, going out and being rowdy. There was this sort of warm, home-centered charity. If one was out in public, it was more to greet one another with Merry Christmas. It was to do good for the poor. Dickens more or less invented that. And his influence has been huge because, of course, that's largely what we do, whether we are secular or even Christians. We generally on Christmas get together with friends and family. We have good food. We play games. There's a much greater concern for doing charity. And
we do have a concern for the poor, unless you're Target.
Yeah. And again, you can, of course, argue that that comes out of the essential nature of Christmas from a Christian point of view. But historically, it comes largely from Dickens' own influence.
And that's at the end of A Christmas Carol. He says, no one kept Christmas better than Scrooge. Keeping Christmas then would mean joining with family, friends, and remembering the poor.
Yes. And in fact, it was said of Scrooge at the end that he kept Christmas all year long, or he promised to continue to do that. In other words, to have that spirit of generosity all year.
This song, of course, perhaps the most annoying of all Christmas carols, especially if it's played in a mall and you have to stand there. I remember at Faneuil Hall at Boston, they had the huge tree, and they probably still do, and they played this 24/7, and the clerks were frantic after 2 days.
Well, I think it was to drive away the homeless.
It was an effective measure. We could probably subdue any part of the world with this. But there is a myth or a legend or perhaps true that this is a symbolic of something.
Well, indeed. It has been proposed, and actually, as you say, it's all over the place. You go on the internet, you look up 12 Days of Christmas, there are probably 5,000 sites that will tell this story. That this song was not as silly as it seems. It was actually written by Catholics in England as a way of teaching the catechism to their children in a time in which they were not free to do that. And you say, what in the world does this have to do with the catechism? It's meant to be symbolic. So the partridge in the pear tree is Jesus on the cross. Two turtle doves are the Old and New Testaments. Three French hens, faith, hope, and love, the theological virtues. The four calling birds are the four gospels. And I won't go all the way through, but you get the point. There are several problems with that. One is, for those who've looked into this stuff and who know about the history of music, there isn't good evidence that this is, in fact, the case. Partly, some of it doesn't work. The calling birds in older English were really collie birds. It's just a kind of bird. In other words, not calling out birds or the gospels. And so, you know, you hate to sort of dump water on people's legends. And if they want to believe that this is really just an allegory, I don't think it does any harm. And frankly, I think it makes a fairly sometimes tedious song at least have a little bit
sometimes
of
sometimes tedious song. Well, let's go to one that's not tedious. Okay. The grandfather of all hymns.
Yes, yes. Well, and there could be a debate about that. Actually, on my website, I put up, you know, sort of my view of the best or my most favored carols, and I'm having interesting input from people who like this and that other one. But I think most people would agree that Silent Night, it pretty much takes the day when it comes to the most popular of Christmas carols. Among other things, it has been recorded as a song more than any other song in history, secular or otherwise. It is the most recorded song. More people have sung it on their albums than anybody else. And so I think we could say Silent Night is sort of the king or the queen of the carols.
Well, now, just pausing for, I can't sing anything, so it's obviously, but it sounds,
you're not going to sing it now?
It's a very hard song to sing, isn't it? I mean, it's not an easy song.
You know, Hugh, it would be, what you need to do is what some of us with lower voices did. We learned to sing the bass line, and that's a very easy line. Otherwise, they go too high. But, you know, the truth is, it's as Christmas carols go, it's easier to sing than some. It's fairly simple. The melody isn't terribly complex. Actually, ironically, the melody we know isn't the original melody.
No, wait, is it the organ broke? You get the guitar?
Yes, the story. You know, much of that story actually is true. And some of it is even a little more interesting. Here is what, again, those who've studied this thing extensively, I'm not one of those, but I've read what they've written. This is what the story is. In 1816, there was a young priest named Joseph Moore. He was serving in a church in Mariapfarr, Austria, and he wrote a six-stanza carol, not a four, a six-stanza carol in German, which was called Stille Nacht or Silent Night. And not, as far as we know, nothing happened with the poem. He was transferred to Oberndorf, Austria, and in 1818, he was getting ready for the Midnight Mass. Now, it was common at that time in the Midnight Mass to use simple or folk songs as well as the religious songs. Now, that's where the guitar comes in. Whether the organ was broken or not, we don't know. There's no evidence that it was. It would have been common to use a guitar anyway. So the idea that this was originally written and performed with guitar, that's quite true. So he had this poem, and on Christmas Eve, he goes over to his friend and the organist of the church, Franz Gruber, shows him the poem and says, can you come up with some music so we can sing this tonight? And indeed, Gruber did, and came up with a tune very similar to the one we sing. There are some slight differences, but mostly it's what we sing. And so that night, Gruber and Moore performed a duet backed up by the choir, accompanied by guitar for the church. And that really was the initial origin of Silent Night.
Don't go anywhere, America. It is Christmas Eve. We celebrate it our traditional way. We put aside the politics and we celebrate Christmas. Enjoy your drive. I'll be right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Bring the torch, and that is a bella. Bring the torch, come swiftly and run. Christ is born, tell the folk of the village. Jesus is sleeping in his cradle. Ah, ah, beautiful is the mother. Ah, ah, beautiful is her son.
One of my favorite Christmas carols on this Christmas Eve with Mark Roberts. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. Let's play that a little bit longer, Adam.
Quiet now while the child is sleeping. It is wrong to talk so loud. Silence now as we gather around. And lest the sound should awaken Jesus. Hush, hush, see how fast he slumbers. Hush, hush, see how fast he sleeps.
Great to be with you this morning, America. I love Christmas Eve. I always have. It's we were a Midnight Mass people, and then we used to go to Mark's church when my kids were little. One memorable Christmas Eve, of course, my oldest son left quite a lot of himself on the steps of the church as he went in. The flu hit. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you remember on Christmas. I remember putting together the toys that no doubt many of you will be struggling with tonight. And all that's behind me. I just enjoy Christmas now, and I hope you do, too. That's why we put together this special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show with Dr. Mark Roberts. It's always great to spend Christmas Eve with Mark.
Now, yeah. You're a linguist. You know your Hebrew. You know your ancient Greek. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you do Latin anymore, but there's translation issues here. Are we close to the original Silent Night?
Well, we get the yes in a way. If you go back and read the six German stanzas, and I've made my way through some of them enough to get a feel for it. Some is close, but some is not. And in fact, one of the more troubling to me aspects theologically of Silent Night doesn't show up in the original. You say, well, what is that? What could be wrong with Silent Night? In our version, Silent Night, Holy Night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild. The picture is a little bit idealized here because though new babies do sleep, they also cry and squall. Mm-hmm. You know, when little Jesus was hungry, it's doubtful that it was a silent night. And I've always sort of was concerned that this gives a picture of Jesus that isn't quite accurate. If you go back to the German original, you get a little different. Here's a sort of Mark's translation, not the greatest. The scholars can, you know, email me and correct me. But most literally, this is what the German reads, first verse. Silent night, holy night. Everyone's sleeping. Only the trusted holy pair are still awake. holy boy with curly hair, sleep in heavenly peace. In other words,
get to bed.
Well, and the holy pair are likely Jesus and his mother.
Sure.
So everybody's sleeping. Everything's quiet, except, you know, poor Mary and Jesus, they're not sleeping. And so it's the holy boy with curly hair, which I find interesting.
More surprises coming up. Don't go anywhere. Christmas Eve edition with Mark Roberts, markdroberts.com. If you want more of that commentary, of that translation. I didn't know you knew German.
Oh, I had to study a little of it.
Psalm singing has been around a very long time. Is this a descendant of that?
Joy to the World?
Yeah.
Yes. Again, the story behind Joy to the World is quite a curious one. And it really does begin with psalm singing in the Reformed Church. Out of the Reformation, there came different branches. One was the Reformed Church. John Calvin was, of course, the main leader of that. And the Reformed Church believed that you should only sing psalms, that is, biblical psalms, nothing else. You can't make up your own song. Again, there was a great concern to stay closely connected to biblical revelation. So some of the psalms don't go easily into English, so you could rewrite the psalm to make it work in English or in German or whatever your language was. And those were called metrical psalms. They were psalms that had meter, so you could sing them. And that was mostly all that the church, especially they say the Puritans in England, would sing. Now, along comes young Isaac Watts, young man, and like most young men around 20, he didn't like the music in church. And he complained to his dad about these terrible old songs. So his dad challenges young Watts, well, if you don't like the songs, you do better. You write your own. And Watts is now known as the father of English hymnody. He is was not only prolific, having written hundreds and hundreds of songs, hymns. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross would be perhaps the most well-known. But what he began doing was taking the Psalms and going through them and rewriting them, basically looking at the Psalm, looking at Jesus and who we are as Christians, and then rewriting the Psalm. And when he got to Psalm 98, he took the text of that Psalm and the reality of Jesus, and he wrote a metrical Psalm out of Psalm 98, not intending to write a Christmas song or a Christmas carol. That's the one that begins, Joy to the World, the Lord has come. If you go back to Psalm 98, and, you know, folk, not that people are driving, don't do this, but okay, Wait till you get home. And if you look at that psalm begins, oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. And there's a call to sing and rejoice. Perhaps after the break, I'll go in and we'll look at the connection between Psalm 98 and Joy to the World.
Hour number two straight ahead. We'll start with Joy to the World. Safe driving on Christmas Eve, America. We'll be right back for the special Christmas Eve edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Room, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing.
Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. A 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384.